Sigiswald Kaiken and La Petite Band with Haydn's Surprise Symphony.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College, and thank you for tuning in to this beautiful music. Speaking of beautiful music, we've got more information on the next performance of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra. Next performance takes place Friday, March 14th. It's called American Showcase, and I know you're going to love it. For tickets or details about additional performances and other things going on with the Dearborn Symphony, please check out their website. It's dearbornsymphony.org, or give the symphony office a call at 313-565-2424. That's 313-565-2424.
WHFR Dearborn.
Hello, you're listening to a special show featuring the 2007 winners of the Francis Barrett Contest and Larry Coulter Poetry Prize at Henry Ford Community College. And I'm Ruth Ann Schmidt, the co-chair of the Barrett Creative Writing Contest. First, you'll hear from the first place winner, Marina Flannery, an honor student at HFCC, who won the Larry Coulter and took top prize in the Barrett. She'll read from a selection of poems with uncanny titles such as Life is Big Rabbit, Then God Put a Finger to His Lips, and Things Seen a Walk. In the second half of the show, Susan Bertoni, an ELI instructor and student at HFCC, will read from a nonfiction memoir entitled Sarah. This piece recounts Susan's time teaching at a Middle Eastern university. But before we listen to these readings, you should know something about the history of the Barrett and the Larry Coulter Prize at HFCC. The Barrett honors Francis Barrett, the first English chair of the English department at Henry Ford Community College, and is in his 33rd year of celebrating student creative writing and poetry, fiction, drama, and creative nonfiction. The Larry Coulter Prize honors the late Larry Coulter, a poet and faculty member of our English division, and the prize is given specifically to an inspiring young poet. If you're interested in submitting work to the Barrett Creative Writing Contest, you must be a currently enrolled student. Submission deadlines for this year is February 26, 2008. Rules can be obtained in the English division, L201 of the Liberal Arts Building. The winners of this year's submissions will be honored on April 17th in L14 from 12:30 to 2 p.m. If you're interested, please apply. Last year, $700 was awarded among the prize winners. And now for the readings. Marina Flannery is the winner of the Barrett Creative Writing Contest and also of the Larry Coulter Prize. Marina Flannery has been writing creatively since the age of 7. And so far, she has assembled 4 books of poems. She's an avid reader of poetry, and her work is influenced by some of her favorite poets. They include Sylvia Plath, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and Shel Silverstein. So you want to go ahead and read something for us, Miranda?
Life is big, rabbit, don't you know? It grabs you up by the scruff of the neck and don't put you down in no wise, little bunny. It be a big thing, rabbit. Twirl you right around and sit you down hard. I know how you want, rabbit, to take it in your hands, don't we all know? And just tie this thing up and make it good and neat. Set it all right, get it all in its proper place. But it's too big for us, rabbit. It never fit in hands like these, all small and shaken like a nightlight. Leaks right through, don't it? Never mind that. A sponge like you wanna soak up all the pretty things, all the ugly things, till you damn near explode yourself. That's a funny game you play. Because it turns out it was all there anyway. Wasn't never nothing to learn nor feel. What a jig. Because we were dancing all along while looking for the steps. Yeah, this is a big thing here. Nothing can keep it all wrapped up and tucked in. Nothing gonna keep this jack in the box. It's big, rabbit, so big. Nothing's bigger than this, you can be sure. But the best part is, of it all, it's all, shh, listen close, inside you and around you and part of you. You're in it, rabbit, stuck right in. You're woven the mesh, you're a part of this play. Oh, life is big, rabbit, yes it is. But that's just how we like it.
You want to talk a little bit about the next one that you're going to read? Is there anything that we need to know?
Oh, yeah. Then God put a finger to his lip. This is one of my favorites. I really love it just because, I don't know, it's so peaceful and, like, still. It's one of the ones where, I think, like, that's what you try to do with a poem. It's, you try to just capture a moment, the essence of a moment. And this is one of my favorites because I think I have a few of those, like, those little moments that I really liked. And then I just, like, put them in a word. And if you can do that, like, just like take a moment, like put it in like a snow globe and then just look at it. Like poems like snow globes, I don't know. But this is one of my snow globe poems, so that's why I like it.
This one is interesting and appeals to me because it seems like all three parts are little pieces of creation that together it's a creation poem. It's about the process of writing a poem, and the last segment sort of leads to that. And so I'll just go ahead and let you read.
This is called Then God Put a Finger to His Lips. 1. Feel that. You can't think about pain and terror when you're feeling that. Is the sun, the heat of it, blanket soft and blood warm, traveling over your skin in a real kiss? It's the calm of the grass wind, sweet bending each little grass in a whisper like a Chopin lullaby. It's the big, safe, thoughtless hug of your mother's, harbored against the cotton of her shirt, half asleep. The light filters through the jars of roots on the windowsill. The clocks have all stopped. Nothing is fearsome now. 2. A child is sleeping. Eyes, little half-shells, tears still stuck in the lace of the lashes. She sleeps in her car seat, crying done, head bowed, nodded. Outside the window, it's newly autumn. The air, biting crisp to the faculties. The trees, stark and whispery, their leaves are shocked. Chlorophyll leaps in their veins. All around the earth, seasons of various climes and systems of various bodies still, yes still, slowly progress. Machines turn in their gears. Someone is howling with laughter. Grass, under which dogs run while barking, is flattened. An airplane takes off, gaining velocity. Lives, filled with passion and grief, tear onward in searing trajectories. There are murders and births, arguments and orgasms, governmental disputes, motorcycle gangs. An old man in a geriatric chair stares into space in the hallway, his hands curled into his body like a fetus. A woman slices her hand and jumps, blood droplets landing on her vegetables. At the red light, a teenager shouts obscenities for the fun of it. The air is still and crisp. The child sleeps. 3. With my notebook, I sit at the table, thoughtfully. Hannah, who is 4, has come into the room, thoughtfully. Rinda, she says, teach me how to write poems.
You said to me earlier that this was your favorite, and I was wondering if you would explain for us why.
Yeah, just because, I don't know, the feeling that I get from it is kind of comforting. Like, especially the first part. You know, just like the warmth and the feeling that like a poem is a place where you can go to sort of seek refuge. And like you can pour those sort of things out onto the paper and sort them out and get a little bit of clarity and closure from it. And writing it as therapy actually is kind of an age-old kind of thing, you know. But it's something I do with my poetry, you know, sort out the world.
Was there something you were sorting out in particular in this particular poem?
Well, yeah, I guess just, you know, the vastness, the bigness of, you know, how everything can be going on, you know, like all how the world is just so large and huge, and yet you're just this one little minuscule eye. I don't know, but there can just this little peacefulness, that like just this one little child sleeping and reposing, and then just experiencing just this lovely kind of, I don't know, this placidness, while at the same time, I don't know, all this war and grief is going on.
The poetry seems to echo those movements pretty easily, and I was just struck by some of the images here that I was just going to pull out for us. The trees, stark and whispery, their leaves are shocked, this sort of miniature. A more miniature view comes in the next line. Chlorophyll leaps in their veins. And then we move out from it all around the earth to the expanse of seasons of various climes and systems of various bodies just sort of sends us out to space. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of very small movement, and then it moves out into these larger images. And I do feel more of a sense of place in this one, so I wondered if I could ask you, it says, after sort of listing these large things moving together, it says, an old man in a geriatric chair stares into space in the hallway, his hands curled into his body like a fetus. A woman slices her hand and jumps. I was wondering who the man in the geriatric chair is, if that's a specific person or an image that just sort of came to you, and who is the woman? It's a very specific and intense moment to think this man is staring out in space, and at the same time a woman cuts her hand and bleeds.
Yes. My grandmother, she was in an old folks, like a nursing home, mm-hmm. called Rivergate Terrace, and she was near the end of her life, and she was in the part of the nursing home where you go when you're losing your ability to take care of the senile.
Uh-huh. Ward. Dementia.
Yes, yeah. The dementia ward. And there was a man who would always be in the hallway and in his jerry chair, and he just, you know, was kind of vacant, and I would always, you know, I would just kind of stand next to him and look at him, and it seemed like this place where they have my grandmother was just very, I don't know, like a place where they just put people to, I don't know, to die. It was very sad to me, like they were all very slumped in their wheelchairs, and I don't know, a lot of them would just be crying to go home. They would say, like, I want to go home, and it would wring my heart, and I don't know, I would want to somehow pay homage to them, so, like, I have a lot of that in my poems. You'll see a lot of the imagery of the elderly people, you know, in the last moments. It's very...
What was the idea of putting it right next to the woman who jumps? Seems like a very energetic... Mm-hmm. Image that mediates vitality and life right next to it.
I like to put the contrasting things together, like for example the governmental disputes and the motorcycle gangs, because I think it's important to realize that even though life is so varied, it's all the same. And I mean, the life that is in this woman that's cutting her hand is still in this old man in the jerry chair. I mean, there's still that thread of life is that sameness is still pervading them both, and it's still there if you can see it, you know.
I wanted you to speak a little bit about Walt Whitman's influence, and particularly his influence in the relationship to this last poem, Things Seen a Walk.
Walt Whitman, I love him. He's one of my favorites just because he's able to perceive and view the world the way it's supposed to be viewed. Like, he sees the brotherhood and the oneness of the universe in all of his people, he's a patriot of the world, and he's a lover of mankind and of life, and it's just so beautiful to read his words. And like Federico Garcia Lorca, who is another poet who is a lover of Whitman, I'm going to quote him. He said, "Never for a moment, Whitman, have I ceased to forget your beard full of butterflies." All right, this is Things Seen Walk, a poem that I write to and from church. It's the mercurial line of gleaming cars on the highway, the reflective metal curves of their hoods, like boulder marbles, like bubbles, like strings of beads. The sun, a great shining bead in the fingers, the sycamores towering stately, leaves broad and large like quilted butterflies, the mosses, nestled in round swells within the arms of the tree roots, a collection of little sprouts evenly ascending from each bump. The seething striations of a submerged tree bank, old, expansive, woodenly wonderful. The arch created by the branches of two maples, one red, one green, the light colored so through their melted leaves. The chorus of cicadas in the high green lace of the branches. The smell of fabric softener, sweet and warm, drifting from the utility room vent where a dryer softly hums. The lumbering, looming giant of an electrical tower, looking down at me as I stand at its base in awe. The clusters of peaches gathered upon the peach tree, heavy and deepening pink, sweet, sweet, soft flesh, slightly furred. The rippling waves of grass, miraculous motion, the ballet of breeze bending each strand of unruly weed or manicured field fringe. The yellow light illuminating the translucent leaf of a dandelion plant. The smell of spicy hot cooking drifting from a kitchen window, garlic, cumin, beef stew, carrots. The wild coo of the morning dove in a rapid, fluid note. The slap of her wings as she takes off in first flight. The little girl with no inhibitions that runs up to give a hug and asks that I will braid her hair, clutching two scrunchies, which I do, and she departs, smiling. 100,000 tiny heart-shaped leaves, all aflutter, all emotion, all dancing on the wind. A carpet of fallen petals beneath an elegantly trimmed rose of Sharon tree, three of them in succession. The sultry scent of damp peonies and soft dew-soaked roses. The rejoiceful chirps of a cloud of sparrows nestled in an oak, interspersed with the coarse call of a magpie. The smell of barbecue pits, wavering, smoky, and bright backyards. The smell of chlorinated pools and fresh-cut lawns. The man in the pickup truck that blows me a kiss. The long, gleaming gazes from the eyes of hesitant squirrels, yet trusting. Cupping acorns, crusts of bread, and little efficient paws. Twitching their whiskered noses, soft furry breasts. The hazy spray of green, bedecking one bush like paint on an otherwise bleak midwinter afternoon. Powder pink blooms dabbed on the tips of a flowering tree like a solitary firework. The streams of slow-moving rainwater trickling down the paths of a tree's bark, lit by the light of a street lamp, shining in the warm, clear summer storm. The many secretive folds of a morel mushroom, little hidden places where fairies sleep undoubtedly. One single morel sprouted up in a clearing. Heavily laden branches, thick with pillows of white blossoms, looking up into their dense twirling of tiny petals. The enormous, fully-flowered dogwood, perfuming the air with large pink, silky blooms, sprouted up from fuzzy little buds. The huge white grubs, wiggling in the stump of rotted wood, twisting with fat-ridged bodies. The sparkling of red broken glass like rubies sprinkled in the mud. The tiny, soft bodies of frog spawn. Little hopping frogs, ever so many, in the earthy slime of the boat whale. Beautiful little tadpoles. The angelic shining eyes of two tiny Asian girls dressed in floral print dresses and bobby socks, clutching one umbrella, and the smaller of the two catching raindrops on her tongue. The chill morning at 6 a.m., a pink sky, the rising sun shining through the millions of dewdrops on the tip of each blade of grass, an incredible ocean of teeny tiny diamonds on the front lawns of my neighbors, lit incredible by the dawn light. The diseased spark of a tree oozing mucus, interesting and textured like hamburger meat and gack, I poke it with a stick. The heavy, angry steam rising from the sewer grate in the middle of the street. The veteran beggarman with no legs that I kiss upon the cheek. The endless fade of railroad tracks extending out into the distance before me, weeds grown up in between each heavy wooden tie and rock, rusty spikes uprooted by the wayside, the majestic plummet of an Amtrak as I quickly move from its path and stand in breathless awe. twinkle of lazy, hazy fireflies bobbing around tree trunks and through glass blades, foggy nights so thick you can drink them and walk on their paths of air, a woman digging in the dirt with her gardening gloves on, brown hair twisted sloppily back, kneeling bare-legged, planting bulbs with a spade. I ask to take her picture. No, she says bashfully. She looks a mess. A stone chimney choked with crawling ivy, sunflowers along a wire fence, a wood pile, lace curtains in the window of a brick house, provoking a hint of comfort and mystery simultaneously, the pink nubs of infant pine cones on a coniferous tree that appear firm, but when touched, disintegrate in a breathless cloud of yellow pollen. His eyes, always his eyes, and God. This next one is called Magic, and I wrote it just because of my my incredible love for Irish folklore and the fairy tales that I would listen to and read as a child. My childhood was steeped in fairy tales and Grimm and Andersen and Perrault, and so I grew up with this. It grew me up, basically. So this is Magic. I'll weave you a yarn, but promise to believe, else all the magic will escape straight away. For magic is curling around the eaves of houses and rustling the leaves on the maples. It envelopes every child secretively with care. It is hidden, but people still believe. Do you hear the wind singing? Smell the seasonal air magic, all's magic everywhere. Robin Redbreast cocks his head and his beady black eyes shine, sleeping for 100 years on a royal bed high above the moors. Ghosts are moving in the courtyard, in the secret annex, in the attic locked. The round yellow moon is waxing full, the dew is settling on the bud. Hear that lullaby calling you to dream with us. Lay your head on our shoulder and sleep, gently now, gently. Feel the soft feathers of the gosling. Taste the ripe apple in the old widow's basket. Hear the wee folk under the mushrooms playing the lute. The music is near. Listen. What lies in the cradle? What sleeps there? Hiding in the milk pitcher, rattling in the walls, in place of sleeping babe, a wise and stumpy fairy, 1,000 years old, the midwife is brewing eggshells. Tiernan Nog is floating out at sea, and will you see it? Golden halls echo trumpet strains and reflect the morning white rays, warm and bright like the center of a flame. Yellow buttercups and bluest sky grace the face of such lost islands. At nightfall in the dark rocks, a light flows from the puka's nostrils. No horse, but horse-like spirit haunting the hills, rolling eyes and wreaking havoc. Shine the lantern light on the shadowy places, and what do you find? A vine that scales the stone wall, a stalk of wheat whose kernels hold a potent potion. A fountain of rainbow-colored drops splash the limestone. The phantom rides his black stallion through the paths of air, a drift of smoke in a warm fireplace, in a pipe, in a patchwork quilt. In brass-buckled shoes, a silk string, a three-cornered hat, and the mystery of hustle-bustle little creatures, squirrel, hedgehog, marmoset, mouse, bearing their spoils they know as well, and the fishermen, too, with wind-whipped beards and parkas sitting in their boats and seeing the dark mermaids out at sea, hearing the song trapped in the conch and the murex. Hear it. Catch the Santa Claus puff of dandelion seed and wish on stars. They shoot with magic. They shoot with sparkle that's magic. The water dragon, the hydra, its jowls spark sharp and bony, its eyes clouded with film from salty oceans. It rises from the froth. Brave knights defend their damsels with heat of battle, passion, and leap of blood courage. The will-o'-the-wisp is twinkling in the bottom lands and bogs, with the green hopping creatures that plop in the cypress roots. Lights of water sheary glimmer, shine, flicker in the only warm of cool swamps. See them. The folds of this Circe cloak house an entire world of mystery, a school of little fishes, a chainmail suit of armor, clouds and stars, planetary rings floating suspended, and what, I ask you, are gravity and electric shock but magic? Poisons and lightning bolts, gardens and music, childbirth and true love, indeed, God. What less have we got from him but utter radiant magic?
Miranda, I just wanted to ask you, I thought that was really funny what you said, that Irish folk tales had grew you up. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just like they were my babysitters. I mean, when my mother was at work, she was going to college when I was young, and my father, he worked at Trenton Engine, and my grandmother would babysit me, but she would, you know, she would do her housework or whatnot, and I would be... You know, I would have my fairy tale books, my Arthur Rackham fairy tales, The Leprechaun's Kingdom by Peter Haining, Fairies by Brian Froud, and I would just look at these books, and I just loved and the illustrations and just the smell, and just, I don't know, they were just my friends, and I just So this poem is so steeped in mythology and image after image after image. And some of them I think are going to be familiar to people who catch them, but many of them are not. So I just wanted to break down a few. Maybe you could tell me about a few here. Who's the man in the three-cornered hat?
Oh, leprechauns.
Leprechauns.
Leprechauns wear three-cornered hats and clericanes.
Okay. And I'm just going to read towards the end of the first. Feel the soft feathers of gosling. Taste the ripe apple in the old widow's basket. Sounds very fairy tale-ish. Is it? Mm-hmm. Is it from an exact fairy tale? Is it?
Well, Snow White.
Snow White. Okay. I wouldn't have thought about that. Hear the wee folk under the mushrooms. That must be the leprechauns playing the lute.
Oh, that would be the fairies, the fairy folk. You know, Queen Mab and her. You know, are you familiar?
No, I'm not
Edmund
familiar.
Spencer?
No, well, actually, the fairy queen, yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the recall that you have there. how about what lies in the cradle? What sleeps here?
Oh, that's. Do you know what a changeling?
A changeling.
A changeling. That's when the fairies, they would steal the children, a newborn child. Like, perhaps if you admire it too much. Or if you say, oh, what a lovely child, the fairies will steal it away. And they'll put in its place a changeling made of ice or wood or an insane old fairy, like disguised as a baby.
Okay.
And brewing of eggshells, that's one way to see if your child is a changeling. You brew eggshells, and this arouses the curiosity of the insane, of the old daffy fairy that's disguised as your baby, and it will make the fairy say, what are you doing? You know, why are you brewing eggshells? And then you know that it's a changeling and not your child.
One last question. Both of these pieces, Things Seen a Walk and Magic, they're constructed with lists of really images. They're both laden with images, and you were commenting on how there's a lot of verbiage, a lot of language before. And I wondered, when you're writing them, do you ever think they're going to spin out of control into other worlds? And how do you bring them back into shape and meaning?
Well, that's actually, I do a lot of editing. Sometimes I just, I'll do a free verse or, you know, just like, I'll just let it flow, let it do what it wants, and I'll go back and pick out parts of my journals or just, you know, free, like writing that I've done and make poems out of it.
Does most of this come from inspiration in journals?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Okay. Any last final thoughts on Things Seen a Walk and Magic?
No, well, Magic is actually, I wrote this one in high school, so this is a pretty...
You mentioned the Fairy Queen. Are you a big fan of Spencer's The Fairy Queen?
I like it, but, like, the really traditional, like, English verse is... I mean, it's actually, I'm more of a fan of contemporary American poetry than
when,
I am.
When were you exposed to The Fairy Queen? Because I wouldn't think... I probably wouldn't have read Fairy Queen unless I was a sophomore in college and was in my early class.
So. What I do is I live in the poetry section of Borders.
You live in the poetry section of Borders.
I just go there for my free time and just sit on the floor and pick out books and read them there because I just love them.
Was that the same with Whitman and Sylvia Plath?
Mm-hmm.
How about Dickinson? How did you first discover Dickinson?
Same way.
And what appealed to you about her work?
Oh, it's just beautiful. She's just... Well, first of all, I relate to her because of her personal life and how she lived as a recluse in her father's house, you know? But she just has this air... She's magical in and of herself. The way she just views the world and nature and eternity and spirituality, and she's a genius. She really is.
Well, It's been great. It's been sort of an introspection of very small images, small and large. Thanks. You're listening to a special show featuring the 2007 winners of the Francis Barrett Contest and Larry Coulter Poetry Prize at Henry Ford Community College. And I'm Ruth Ann Schmidt, the co-chair of the Barrett Creative Writing Contest. In the second half of the show, Susan Bertone, an ELI instructor and student at HFCC, will read from a nonfiction memoir entitled Sarah. This piece recounts Susan's time teaching at a Middle Eastern university. Susan did her undergraduate studies in Middle Eastern and Jewish studies at
Northwestern, and a TESOL degree at Eastern Michigan. Susan, tell us a little bit about the historical and political context of the story.
Okay. The historical context was it was the first year of the Second Intifada, which is uprising. So this was in 2000. It was in the West Bank in a northern town called Jenin. And I was an English instructor at a new university. And the story is about one of my students and her, actually the beginning of our relationship, because she came to me in this difficult time of hers, and I've been in touch with her ever since.
What was the name of the university?
The Arab American University in Jenin.
Okay, and you were teaching, again, you were teaching English.
English is a second language,
English,
yes.
English is a second language. And it's fair to say that maybe we should tell the readers that the student is compromised, somewhat compromised.
Yeah, she had been attacked by another student whom she thought was a friend of hers or even a boyfriend of hers.
So we're going to take a look at how that affects her, the cultural and political effects of that incident here. Is there anything else you want to say or set us up for understanding the particular culture of the time period?
The fact that she had been attacked by a male student or a male at all really did put her in a dangerous situation in the West Bank. The culture there doesn't really accept such things happening, and they often blame the victim, sometimes to dire consequences. So she was actually almost in fear of her life when she came to me. So.
Did you see that a lot, or was this just one isolated incident with girls or women coming of age in Palestine?
It's hard to see because such things are often left hidden. This girl in particular was, well, I won't say, you'll hear at the ending, but she was safe at the end, but you heard about such things. You didn't always encounter them face to face.
Did you find it hard to believe when it happened or when it occurred?
It was hard to feel so helpless. She was asking for my help, and there's only so much I could do in that context. So,
you want to go ahead and let us hear,
sure.
Sarah.
Yeah. Okay. It was a hot, humid September afternoon at the university. The campus sat on the plain of Megiddo, predicted site for Armageddon. A soft haze hung over the sun-baked squares of dark green and nut-brown land that surrounded the campus. Lack of forethought on the part of the architects placed the university building facing north and south rather than east and west, so all of us inside got the maximum amount of sunlight exposure and heat. The buzz of student activity floated up with the warm breeze and through my office windows. Kids shouted, laughed, and bellowed to one another, voices echoing off the sun-bleached patio. Orange Mercedes taxis and decrepit blue and white buses idled on the spongy asphalt below. Hands, elbows, heads, and chromatic-scaled music emerged from open car windows. Strained pings of bouncing basketballs echoed off everything else. I dozed on a stack of worksheets that needed to be graded by the next morning. The students were working on if clauses. If I have a holiday next month, I will go to Jenin to visit my uncle. If I were a policeman, I would catch all the stellars. I guessed he meant stealers. If I had $1 million, I would give 70% of it to build new hospitals and schools and to improve the streets in my country, whereas the 30% would be spent on buying all my family's needs. If I went to a deserted island for a week, I would take my honey with me because I want to spend a fun time. I would take my girlfriend because she will kill me if I didn't. A burst of uproarious laughter from the adjacent office jarred me awake. Abdullah, the sociology instructor, was chiding a student for not studying. Her response, La ustaz, anjad darasat manih, shu hadha haki. No, professor, really, I studied well. What kind of talk is that? It was time for a Coke. My mouth tasted like the Turkish salad from lunch. I pulled open the flimsy door to the hallway and came face to face with one of my students from the 10 o'clock intermediate class, Sarah. My mind pulled up its data on her. Quiet. Rarely does homework. Got a 65 on the last test. Rose motif on all of her notebooks. Swathed in olive green, Sarah's round face looked pale and stricken. Her mouth and hands twisted in pathetic unison. Cracked lips parted, and out rushed the sour breath of one who has neither eaten nor drunk anything all day. Miss? Hello, Miss. Miss Suzanne. Cold, damp fingers, like those of a tree frog, reached out for my hands and grasped them fervently. Can I come in? Sure. I hovered in the doorway, jangling my cinnamon Altoids box full of change. Can I get you something to drink? She sank into the orange chair near my desk and shook her head, then tilted it sideways and downwards. A trace of a smile twitched on her lips and vanished. Her spindly index finger traced the side of my desk back and forth. Student in crisis, I thought. I'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay here. She looked at me with watery brown eyes, filled with silent and desperate apology. For what, I wondered. My eyebrows crinkled into a frown as I shut the door. Abdullah stood in his doorway, his buzzing gaze following his students, who were already halfway down the hall, trailing a cloud of the new local fragrance. It was called Me, a musky baby powder scent sold in Israeli and better Ramallah stores. One student wore faded tight jeans and a lemon-yellow hijab, the other overalls, powder pink clogs, hair sleek in a copper bob. Stifled giggles erupted from them, followed by a great whoop as they rounded the corner. So, Miss Suzanne, what's new? His smiley eyes fell on me as he smoothed his Donald Duck tie, teeth gleaming white in a sunny bronzed face. I jerked my thumb towards the door. I've got a student here. Do you want a Coke or something? Sure, or something. He rummaged in an ocean of pocket coins and pulled out 15 shekels, my treat. No, I've got it. What do you want? He pressed 2 coins in my hand, then drummed his fingers on the door jamb. Surprise me. I dodged clusters of students on my way downstairs. Village boys holding one another's hands and drinking chocolate milk boxes. The Nazareth girls, perfectly preened, posing on the railings. This, the only building on campus, is their student union, I thought. I remembered the one at my university, which stretched 5 stories up and overlooked Lake Michigan. 2 universities worlds apart, yet they can both offer the purring red comfort of the student union Coke machine. I punched in a Diet Coke for me, a Coke for Abdullah, a Fanta for Sarah, and trekked back upstairs. Sarah hadn't moved from her spot. I cracked open the Fanta and set it in front of her. Miss, I feel so bad. Her trembling tree fog hands reached out for mine again. I sat down on the desk and looked at her, held both her hands. Miss. Yes, Sarah, drink something, please. She sipped and wiped her gummy mouth with her sleeve. Miss, I feel that you have a white heart. I see it in your face. The other students can be very foolish sometimes in the class, and I feel sorry for that. She was referring to Mahmoud, the larger-than-life Fatah guy, and his disciples, who often got carried away with the spirit of group work. It's not your fault, Sarah. You know boys. She nodded violently. Yes, I know them. She gazed out the window, a weariness weighing down her eyelids. I'm so tired from inside. Miss, before 2 weeks, I knew nothing about the life. I only knew about the blood. Her free hand made a motion down her slender body, not unlike the sign language word for menstruation. And now I know about all. She closed her eyes and flinched, as if images were coming at her face. There was a long silence as I waited for more. She stared down at the floor. What happened to you? She sniffled, paused. You know Mohammed, the boy with the light hair from Saudia? He was in our class. Yes. I hadn't seen him in a week. He's very bad. Her voice cracked into a sob, and she began rocking her body back and forth, trance-like. Tabana, ana kthir tabana, daiche. What she's saying is, tired, I'm so tired, dizzy. I shook her stiff, narrow shoulders. Sarah! She looked at me levelly. Miss, can I stay in your apartment tonight and maybe the next night? Why? She clutched my arm. I was afraid to go home, miss. I am afraid to go home. All the students, they saw me coming from his house. I wore his pants. He tore mine. He did it. He said he wanted to show me something, some pictures, and I saw them. They were very, very bad. And my family, they will not understand. Tabane, Kdir Tabane. She stood up, faced the door, and then slid down the wall, her torso curved over like a bendy straw. With one arm cradling her head, I knocked on the wall for Abdullah. He came in laughing. Where the hell's my coat? His grin faded. Sarah's head was bent over like a rag doll's. He knelt down and peered into her face, looked sharply at me. What happened? She panicked, and then he stared at me, trying to glean more than I was offering. Is she passed out? See. I touched her cheek. No response. He grabbed her under her damp armpits, laying her gently atop a pile of flimsy workbooks from the 9 o'clock beginner's class. Just then, the pompadour of Jihad glided past my door. Our only chemistry professor, Jihad, spoke Mississippi English and Kalkilia Arabic like the falah, which means farmer, that he was. His face froze in the doorway as he looked down at us on the floor. What the hell? Abdullah raised his chin slightly. Yeah, Jihad, go get the nurse, quickly, please. Abdullah and I stared at each other, eyes dueling, in the few moments before the nursing staff arrived. Susan, what happened to this girl? She's under a lot of pressure, I said lightly. We both watched her chalky face, caked lips, small, troubled bosom rising and falling. Pressure. He mulled it over. You know more than this, and you're not telling me. Haven't you heard of confidentiality? I snapped. The scuffle of feet and voices grew louder and finally burst through the door. Several men gathered around Sarah's limp form, lifting her onto the stretcher. She opened her eyes, looked wildly around her, and stiffened. The men talked over us, urging me to back off. Khalas, leave it to us, Suzanne. I couldn't. I held onto her tree frog hand as we bumped down the hall. We entered a classroom space partitioned into a few private sections, like an emergency room. It smelled like iodine sawdust, with a faint hint of cabbage and vinegar salad. The entrance featured a library of colorful pamphlets about drugs, alcohol, nutrition, and the dangers of early marriage. Adorning the wall were a few 1970s-era healthy living posters in English. The Get High on Life one featured four young people with shaggy hair sitting on the grass and playing guitar. The name of Anwar Rabi was scrawled above the head of the shaggiest man, indeed an unfortunate and uncanny resemblance to the university physics professor. The men lifted Sarah off the stretcher and onto an examination bed. Dr. Ghassan, the medical dean, stepped to her left side and placed both of his large, long-nailed hands high on her rib cage, his thumbs resting neatly under her breasts. I opened my mouth to protest, but thought better of it. Sarah, he brayed, as his hand moved slightly back and forth over her rib cage. She said nothing, but wrinkled her brow and frowned. Meanwhile, Rami, the nurse, had fastened a blood pressure cuff around her upper arm. Sarah, if you can hear me, squeeze Suzanne's hand. Dr. Ghassan nodded to me. Sarah squeezed. Rami and his assistant prepared an IV of salt and sugar solution and deftly inserted a needle into her arm. Dr. Ghassan motioned for me to meet him in the hallway. He gathered Abdullah and me into a tight circle. Suzanne, did Sarah tell you why she is so frightened? His thick lips and tongue emphasized each syllable, somehow turning his whisper into a shout. My eyes darted from him to Abdullah. She said she was under a lot of pressure from her family. I thought at first it was just her exams, but I don't know. Hassan drew our heads even closer together, so I inhaled his cigarette breath, Abdullah's cologne, and someone's aerial detergent. It seems that she was friends with a boy named Mohammed who had been making trouble for a lot of girls here at the university. Did she ever mention him to you? Rust-brown eyes searched my face. I caught a trace of a smile from Abdullah as he rocked back slightly on his heels. Tell a half-truth, I thought. Well, I knew she was friendly with him. I mean, not friendly, but they used to sometimes talk before class. God, did I sound like a bubble-brained American. It was working. Dr. Lausanne's eyes started to glaze over. I continued, what kind of trouble are you talking about? And where's Mohammed been for the past week? I've missed him in class. I thought he was just lazy. The doctor began backing up towards the clinic door, fumbling in his pocket for his mobile phone. Abdullah raised his eyebrows at me and turned the edges of his mouth down. Not bad. Back in the clinic, Sarah's wide eyes panned the room, her face smiling weakly for the benefit of a couple I could only guess were her parents. Later, I would come to know her mother as a hoarse-voiced, theatrically funny woman, and her father as a gentle and devoted husband and father. But at that moment, their mood was dour, their stance Palestinian Gothic. As they listened to the nurse give Sarah's diagnosis, which was pressure from school and not eating well, her mother tugged repeatedly at her veil, emerald green eyes staring out of a heart-shaped, slightly wrinkled face at a space just above Sarah's head. The father alternately looked down at his thick fingers or at a point far in the distant hills out the window. I nodded at both of them as Sarah made awkward, formal introductions in English and Arabic. Her mother leaned over and murmured something in Sarah's ear. Sarah flushed slightly. My mother says you must come to our home for dinner tomorrow. More emphatic murmurs erupted from both of her parents. For the first time in a week, I saw Sarah's face relax into a smile as she stretched her thin arm out with a flourish, nearly pulling the IV from her vein. They say that you have no choice. You have no choice. Some choices are made on our behalf. A few weeks after this incident, Sarah's family chose to send her to the U.S. to live with an aunt. For 2 years after Sarah left, her picture was taken from the living room of her family's house and moved to a small alcove in her parents' bedroom, yet her mother would cry whenever I visited. I reminded her of Sarah, her sisters explained to me. Sarah's absence was a physical ache that the six other children, aunts and uncles and cousins and neighbors, could never ease. Her siblings frankly admit, and without bitterness, that her mother loved Sarah more than all of them. She was their firstborn. Her life since she has left has not been easy by any means. I've heard new updates on her story on subsequent visits. She is meskina, a poor thing, and taibe, kind, her parents tell me with anguish. She is used to being taken advantage of. I nod knowingly, trying not to conjure up the Polaroid photograph of her that I saw one time at their house. In it, she is about 13, wearing an off-the-shoulder prom dress with visible discomfort, as if she has been forced into it. Her shiny, liquid eyes are pleading for someone to stop.
What is the significance of, they say you must have, they say that you have no choice, both maybe what it means in the story really literally and metaphorically, okay. How it plays out?
When she said that to me, what she was saying was, you have no choice, you must come to dinner with us. So that was kind of a happy context.
But then later you're talking about her choice to leave.
Yeah.
And her being stuffed into a skinny prom dress.
Yeah. Some choices are made on our behalf, like I said in the story. So, in fact, I don't think she chose to go away, but it was sort of forced upon her.
After whatever happened, and it's never really explicitly said, what happens by the nurse. The nurse's reaction is she's just been studying too hard, right? How is it that her parents know? Or there's a lot unsaid.
Yeah, there's a lot unsaid. This really happened. And it turns out that eventually her family did find out that something happened. The sort of underground spy network was after this guy and approached her family and said, you know, this man is wanted and he's escaped from us. But it wasn't to get her in trouble. It was sort of to rally forces to find this guy.
And I don't know, in the wake of finding him, she was one of the casualties.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose my earlier question when this happened, did it surprise you, was to get at this kind of, is it like this for both boys and girls, men and women at this time, that if boys were equally exploited or were exploiting someone, that the shame would be, or the sense of isolation would be equally brought down upon both in the family?
Well,
that's just for girls.
The girls definitely bear most of the brunt of the shame when that happens, for sure. This guy that was the perpetrator, his family wasn't Palestinian. He was from Saudi Arabia, I think, and he escaped to Jordan somehow. So I don't know what would have happened to him, but his life wouldn't have been in danger.
So
hers was.
Did it shock you when her parents actually did send her away?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
No.
I have a question earlier about something that happens in the story. You're about ready to follow her into the examining room, I'm mm-hmm. guessing, the examining
yeah.
room at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And the male professors say, don't follow us. We'll take care of it from here. What did you think was going on at that, and what was going on?
Well, I don't think there was anything, you know, insidious going on. They just felt like now they were in charge, and you know, I didn't have to worry about anything. It was like sort of like she was in good hands.
So they weren't protecting or keeping you from any?
No, they weren't. I mean, they were just saying, oh, we have it, don't worry about it, you know, we can handle it, you know, she's sort of our problem or our business now, you don't have to worry. That was the message I got. Now, the doctor that I pointed out that his hands were a little too high on her chest, I thought that they were too high on her chest. And it was sort of like a proprietary way of handling a patient, which wasn't necessary, I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a sense, I mean, at least had a sense of what had happened without telling her mother. That was the other curious thing, which I think you might have addressed earlier. How did they get the sense, how did they get that sense, and you did your best not to give that impression, right, to sort of steer them away from the impression that she actually knew the shady character, I want to say Abdullah?
Yeah, well, Abdullah wasn't necessarily shady, but this, Abdullah was sort of, he was a colleague of mine, and, there were already rumors going around about this guy, Muhammad, who had been inappropriate with not just one girl, but more than one. But there was definitely a sense of separating that sort of business from women if you could help it. So
you knew you had to protect her at that moment, or?
No, well, I thought I was protecting her, but really everybody had already knew what happened at that point, but I didn't know that. So I was sort of saying, well, I have no idea. I'm just this, the kind of airheaded.
So when the
foreigner.
Doctor's eyes glossed over.
Yeah.
Is it all?
Yeah.
Another real story.
Yeah, it's better. It's in situations like that with the type of rumor mills that go on there, it's better to just say, I don't know.
Could you speak a little bit about the rumor? What is the rumor mill and how does it work in that culture?
The rumor mill is, I think, because it's such a sort of community-based culture where people definitely know one another's business. Often information is rarely private. And so...
Mostly spread by word of mouth?
Yes. Things are very quickly spread by word of mouth. And people often don't question the source. They just sort of believe it, or they pretend to believe it, especially if it's something shocking. So if it's something like, well, did you hear that someone is a spy? People might not really believe it in their hearts, but if they question it, then they would look unpatriotic. So everybody says, oh, he's a spy, he's a spy.
And it would work the same way?
With rumors about scandalous behavior, with anything. And people don't want to associate themselves with such behavior, so they're quick to say, oh, my gosh, can you believe that? Rather than say, well, I know this person and probably this didn't happen and this person's my friend, for fear of being tarnished.
Susan, I wondered if you would elaborate on some of the differences between fiction and nonfiction and how the art of fiction may have shaped the real experience into story.
Okay. You know, it seems that a lot of my writing in the past several years has been based on true stories, or even more than based on is actually, I would call it nonfiction with a little bit of manipulation. So I don't know what on the how that falls on the continuum. This happened, and maybe a few of the cameo appearances I put in, like Abdullah and Jihad. Although they were there when she fainted, and it all happened pretty much, I won't say exactly as I wrote it, but very similar. I wanted to, though, put a focus on Sarah much more than I saw when she first came to me. Like, I saw her as just sort of a student with a problem. And as I got to know her family, I was asked back there many times, I think largely because, you know, I'd helped her, but also they missed her so much, and they sort of saw me as almost not a replacement, but just sort of like a foster sister or foster daughter, and I was honored that they did that. But as I knew her family more, I wanted to sort of tell her story a little bit more clearly, with the focus on her. And like I was saying, that photograph really struck me that I saw in her family's, you know, collection of photographs, and it made me wonder what had happened to her, because I think something had happened to her, and I don't know what it was.
Can you remember some of the things that you may have left out?
I really didn't leave much out. I might have added some things in, like the beginning when I was sleeping on my desk. Maybe I was sleeping on my desk another time, but, you know, the Turkish salad every day and the sounds outside, they were pretty par for the course. But I really didn't leave much out. At least I don't think I did. Remember, this was 7 years ago.
It may be that memory has shaped it into story as well.
Yeah.
And that often can shadow our awareness or lack of awareness of fictional technique.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, there is a lot of comparison, and it's inherent in the cultural comparison, your immersion in this culture. There was a line that struck me about the Coke machine, that in these two different universities, mm-hmm. there's this Coke machine, and every detail being significant in fiction. I wondered if you could speak to it. How do you see that as the comparison of the two universities? You speak a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I was at the time, let's say 2000, I was, what, 27 or 28, and 10 years out of, about 6 years out of university. So here I was teaching university students, and I felt kind of like a young teacher anyway, but when I compared my experience as a university student and their experience, it seemed, in so many ways, it seemed completely different. But in the human interaction department of, you know, knowing, you know, being friends with the opposite gender, you know, at the university in Jenin, things were much more limited. Students didn't live in the same dorm. Students couldn't stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning, like, you know, watching Nick at Night and running around in the sprinklers, you know, things like that that were so fun. But they did, it was an exciting time in their lives as far as being young adults, and I thought that there were certain commonalities that I think every student should experience. They had it much more in a limited way than I had it, and I always felt that disparity when I was there.
What kinds of things, what kinds of things did you do to sort of highlight and focus Sarah's character?
I remember just details of how she reacted when she was nervous as opposed to when she was relaxed, and how different she was. I remember that day when she came to my office, and it was clear she hadn't eaten or drunk anything. It was clear that, you know, she hadn't slept or showered in like a few days, and she was just a nervous wreck. And I remembered how her hands were, and how they were kind of long and spindly with, I don't know, like a tree frog. The last fiction class I took was when I was about 10. It was from Naomi Shihab Nye, by the way. But that's beside the point, yeah. I couldn't name the techniques.
Were you really conscious of the comparisons that are being made between... You must have been pretty aware of those comparisons between relaxedness and calmness versus nervous. What is safe in the culture versus mm-hmm. what is kind of dangerous in the culture, and the differences between the American version of college mm-hmm. that we just talked about, and yeah. possibly how much of that they had experienced in their college life, and how mm-hmm. much was very different or shaped by their own culture. So you were aware of that in the beginning, or is it something that just appeared once you started writing?
You mean the
comparisons? Were you aware that you were making those connections and comparisons? There's I'll pull it out. There's even a comparison about a poster that somebody is, I think, scribbled a mustache
hilarious.
On.
No.
Scribbled a mustache on or defaced to make it look like he looks like the physics
professor. He actually looked just like the physics professor, but they just wrote his name above. It was one of those, like, from the 1970s, I think, you know, Get High on Life.
Which is we think of an American kind of...
It was an American kind of poster, and so it was yellowed. It was, ancient. It could have been bought on eBay. But this picture of four young people, you know, with a guitar in the grass, and someone had written the name of the professor, like, above this guy's head, and it looked exactly like the professor. It was so funny.
Were you aware of the comparisons that could be made from that as a kind of image or symbol, or did that just come out?
It just was. There's a lot of crossovers there. Like, one time I remember I was in a taxi in Amman, Jordan, with my friend, and we were there for, like, the weekend, and the taxi driver turned on The Gambler by Kenny Rogers and knew all the words. So there's a lot of those crossovers that you don't even think about after a while, because the two worlds seem as one. And so people talk about culture shock. I don't know if I experienced exactly culture shock. To me, it's sort of blending all one culture, Arab-American, still. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what's normal anymore, what I knew as normal before I came there,
uh-huh.
and before I left there. All of my sort of cultural mores are upside down now.
So it was something you didn't think about when you sat down to write.
No, it was not something I thought
about. In the fabric of the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Great. For more information about the Francis Barrett Creative Writing Contest and the Larry Coulter Poetry